If you're enjoying the Teas Made podcast, I would love for you to check out my blog, which is also called The Teas Made. We're doing something called the So Slow Book Club, where I'm writing about the same book all year long, and I'm writing regular essays on everything from sending kids to college to why and what I'm loving creating in the kitchen these days. When you subscribe for free, you'll get my posts in your email inbox, or you can jump in on the conversation over at my page. I also have some optional goodies for paid subscribers that you're going to want to check out too. Spring is here, and I have a long list of topics I'm planning to cover. Everything from updated skincare recommendations to some recipes for fun spring-themed beverages. Come join the conversation about connection and creativity at theteasmade.com. Hi, friend. You're listening to the Teas Made podcast, and I'm so glad you're here. I'm Megan Francis, a writer and a midlife mom of five living in Michigan. In this podcast, we'll talk about some of my favorite things like books, creativity, outdoor adventure, and of course, warm beverages. And I'll share practices that can help you infuse your home, work, and family life with a sense of intention, comfort, and connection. The tea's made, so settle in, get comfortable, and let's chat. Hi, friend. Welcome to this episode of The Teas Made. You know, I have been loving recording this new podcast. It's really different from other podcasts I've hosted and produced over the years, and there have been many. I've spent many hundreds of hours recording episodes for The Mom Hour and the podcast formerly known as Mother of Reinvention, and then some of my older podcasts that aren't even around anymore, like my very first podcast, The Kitchen Hour, that I launched in 2012, if you can believe it. But with this podcast, it was really different. I didn't go in with a clear format or a business plan or a specific audience I was trying to reach. I just wanted to share pieces of my life with you. And I wanted to do it in this format, not only because I've become so comfortable with podcasting, but also because it's intimate and warm. It feels really hospitable. And that's the kind of feeling I want you to take away as you listen, maybe with a cup of tea. And by the way, right now I am drinking a cup of oolong tea that I made from leaves I harvested from a tea plant I bought last week. I know what? That is kind of extra. I'm not even going to get into that too much right now because it is a whole other topic for a whole other episode. But just in case you were wondering, yes, it is possible. Anyway, one of the trickiest things about sharing your life on a blog or in a podcast is that people only see little glimpses. And often that's just because we all live full lives and we have many aspects of our personalities. And there's often just not enough time in a weekly podcast to share everything. And also in creating a place that's welcoming and inclusive, it can be hard sometimes to know how to share things that might not sit well with every listener or that may actually feel threatening or offensive to some. I know for me, one of the pieces that has not fully been explored or shared here in this space is the fact that after a long hiatus from practicing any kind of spirituality at all, I returned to the Christian faith in late 2018, very tentatively at first, and then with more and more conviction about the path I was on. And I've been pretty quiet about that online because I've never really felt like I fit in churchy spaces. Maybe you know what that feels like. And I know how alienating that whole world can feel if you've never been part of it, or if, like me, you've been part of it but then bowed out for whatever your reasons were. I guarantee if I had been listening to a favorite podcaster even earlier in 2018, and they started talking about how they went back to church, I probably would have immediately skipped the episode. That is how tender that place was for me, and that was not very long ago. So I definitely try to be mindful of that. All that said, last Sunday, I had the honor of speaking at Storyline, a church in my community that really was a safe haven for me when I was just taking those tiny little steps back. This was my fourth time speaking at Storyline, and maybe the time I got the most feedback and felt the most connected to the community. The talk weaves together parenting and the awkward middle space I'm in with my kids, and how digging back into the Bible as an adult helped me realize the truth of a good story. It should be real and hopeful, and it should help us feel like we belong. There's also a funny story about my childhood and my older brother in there, so it was a really fun talk. I will share more about my return to faith in another episode sometime. But right now, I just wanted to share the audio of my talk. I worked on it most of last week, so I really didn't have time to outline a different episode anyway. And also, it's just something I want to share with you as another aspect of who I am. A note that I am only including the audio of me talking. I cut out the music, which is great, by the way, but I don't have permission from all the musicians to include them in this podcast. However, if you're interested in watching the whole talk, including the music, I will also include a link to the video in the show notes. And if this kind of episode isn't for you, that's okay. No worries. And I will be talking to you again next week. Okay, now we're going to listen to my talk from Storyline Church in St. Joseph, Michigan. Good morning. Happy Sunday. I'm Megan Francis, if you don't already know me. I'm really hoping that the tech will cooperate today. And if not, I've got my paper copy and my reading glasses right over there. So I think I'll be good. So when I was a kid, my brother John and I used to go to a Wednesday evening youth group with some family friends. It wasn't the church our family went to, but it was known as the best youth group in town. It pulled in lots of kids from other local churches, and no, that was not in this town. I think that's similar all around the land. And it also brought in a lot of kids who didn't go to any church. They always had great programming, they had fun music, they had games. And I think this was the real draw. They also served tons of super junky snacks. So I liked that this youth group wasn't at my family's home church because that meant I had a whole new audience to show off to, specifically my skills in memorizing Bible verses. I was the kid who would memorize every single verse, every single week, sometimes to earn a prize, sometimes just to get approval from the adults, and often to feel a little bit superior to the other kids, including my brother. My older brother also really liked this youth group, but I always got the feeling he was really just there for the food. And because this wasn't our home church, my mom wasn't there, and she would never know. She would never know that he absolutely gorged himself every week on Doritos and Faygo Red Pop and this whole smorgasbord. And I wouldn't say my mom was like against treats or against sugar or anything like that, but she definitely had a sense of propriety about it and like proportion. In my mom's world, you did not just go to a church buffet and stuff 16 cookies in your face and like wash it down with half a jug of Kool-Aid. You took a reasonable amount and you ate it like a respectable human being. My brother was the kind of kid who really bristled under limits of any kind. And if you have kids, maybe you have one of those. He was always looking for ways to break the rules. And he just really liked junk food, really loved sugar. So one Wednesday when he was about 12 and I was about 8, we had just gotten home from youth group. And this particular night had really been one for the books for me, I gotta say. So we were in the middle of this lesson that was called Fishers of Men, and we'd each been given a little white sailor hat, and then you could earn pins for the sailor hat by memorizing Bible verses. Well, there was only one thing I liked better back then than the prizes and better than the adult approval, and that was getting to feel kind of smug and self-righteous, especially compared to my brother John. And I had cleaned up that night. I had memorized every single verse, all the assigned ones plus the bonus ones. Those were the really hard ones. I had no idea what they were about, but never mind that. I got the pins. I had so many pins. This hat was covered. My brother's night had gone a little bit differently. I don't think he brought home any pins ever. In fact, I think he lost the hat the first night we got it. He might have like thrown it at another kid and then just ran off and left it. But he did hit that cookie tray and that chip bag and the Faygo Red Pop so hard that the sugar coated his teeth and then the red dye number 40 from the pop like stuck to the sugar. So my brother comes home that night with all of his night's sins literally adhered to his teeth, this big red smile. And all the way home, our friend's parents were driving us. I'm thinking, oh, I can't wait till my mom sees this. I was feeling so smug, even smugger than usual. And so we come into the house, and I sit down in the rocking chair in the living room, and I get out my Bible, and I kick back, kind of just waiting for the judgment to begin. And in the meantime, of course, I started getting ahead on next week Bible verses because I planned to memorize every single one and totally own all the other kids there. I was going to win more pins than anybody. And now I'm sure at least one of those verses was probably about humility, maybe something in there about, you know, like family love, loving your brother, maybe something about compassion. I don't know. It doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. I wanted the pins. Okay. Now, listen, I wasn't looking for my brother to be like dramatically taken out or anything like that. I loved my brother. He's still one of my very best friends. But I really wanted that recognition for being so good. So in my fantasy of how the night would go, I thought maybe at some point my mom would kind of lean over and notice and say how nice it was to see me sitting there reading my Bible. And then she might sort of cast a somewhat disgusted look at my brother and say something like, gosh, it sure would be nice to see you reading your Bible. That's not how that night played out. And in the end, I don't actually remember if she even noticed what I was doing, but that is what my righteous little 8-year-old heart wanted so much at that moment. So I'm sitting in the rocking chair. I'm repeating Bible verses under my breath. I am just marinating in my own goodness. And my mom is on the end of the sofa nearest me, and then at the other end of the sofa is my brother. And he's not looking too hot. And I mean, it's understandable because at that very moment that I'm committing John 3:16 to memory, my brother John has got about 2 liters of carbonated corn syrup and a pound of cookies and chips making their way through his digestive system. So I'm watching him out of the corner of my eye, just waiting for that moment of reckoning when my mom will finally lay into him. And then suddenly, in one motion, he sits up, he turns his head, and he projectile vomits a Faygo Red Pop Dorito geyser right onto the rug. And we all froze. Because it took some time to actually realize what had just happened, right? I didn't actually think people threw up with that much force and precision. It was like CGI, really. It's just in my mind, that's all I can see. And then, while a little tiny part of me still wants my mom to give my brother the business, a bigger part of me is kind of terrified because things just got real, right? This was proof that he'd made a glutton of himself, and the evidence of all of his transgressions were literally in plain sight, like all over my mom's rug, which was beyond saving, and we definitely did not have the money to replace it. So there's a couple things you should know about the rest of the story. Number one, this wasn't the first throw-up incident, including my brother, okay? There was another story that had become family legend about a time where we were all sick, including my mom, and she was down on her knees changing my diaper on the floor, and my brother climbed on her back and threw up on her and me over her shoulder. So that was like family legend. But I'm not going to accuse him of intentionally wielding his vomit like some kind of weapon or anything. He was just that kid. He was the kind of kid who got himself into so many messes. He was really strong-willed, and he and my mom butted heads a lot as he got older. And you should also know that my mom was also pretty stubborn, and she was a single mom of 4 kids, and she ran a daycare out of our home. So by the end of the day, she was done. She did not have time or patience for nonsense, and this was a lot of nonsense. So the little scene that was playing out in our living room suddenly felt like a tinderbox. And I think when you're a kid with siblings and there's some kind of drama, there's a little part of you that kind of wants your sibling to kind of get what they have coming. Like maybe it's a payback for all those times you had to do the dishes, even though it was their turn, or they got the better fork. Or maybe the times they waited at the top of the stairs to jump out and scare you when you went to bed like every night for 2 years, like my brother did to me. But then there's the other part of you who feels like your sibling is on your team and you don't actually want them to die. And in that moment, I wasn't sure he was gonna make it. I sat there waiting for something really terrible to happen, like maybe he'd get like struck by lightning or turn into a ball of fire or a pillar of salt or something. I mean, I think some of those Bible verses I had been reading had some smiting in them, and that might have been, you know, in the back of my head. So anyway, there was a large amount of tension in the air. And today, with the benefit of being a mom myself, I just kind of remember my mom taking this really slow inhale while the angel and the devil on, you know, either shoulder kind of battled it out. And then after a beat, she just looks at my brother and says, "Do you feel better now?" And then the two of them rolled up the rug and they took it out to the road to be picked up by the trash collectors. And I went to bed. And I have to say, I felt a little deflated. All of my accomplishments that night, all of the things I was so proud of, had been completely overshadowed by my brother's dramatic regurgitation. And all of my goodness had gone kind of unnoticed, or at least overshadowed by like this digestive exorcism that had just happened. And it just didn't seem fair. I had gone from being the hero of the story that I was writing in my head to being a pretty forgettable character. So I'm working on a book right now. I have a publisher, I have a contract, I have a deadline just about 3 months away. And it's starting to dawn on me, especially because I went back and read all the fine print in the contract, that they actually are serious about that deadline. I was kind of hoping they didn't mean it, but they do. So I'm spending a lot of time right now thinking about this book and asking myself what I'm trying to accomplish with it. And then panicking because I'm pretty sure I'll never get it done. And then the panicking takes up the time and the energy that I could be using to write. So then I find myself looking for things to do to distract me from that panic, like speaking right now. When Mike asked me to speak this weekend, I was like, yes, I am on it. Because for a writer, there's no better procrastination than working on a piece of writing that's not the writing you're supposed to be working on. So anyway, this book has been kind of tough to get traction on. And I think that's partly because it's really personal, and partly because I'm actually living through what I'm writing about right now. It's a book about parenting, but it's not a parenting advice book. It's more about the experience of motherhood as you go from actively parenting little kids to shifting into sort of a different kind of motherhood as your kids get older. I have 5 kids. The oldest is 26, and the youngest is almost 15. So I am in the middle of this really weird period where I'm going from having a full house just a few years ago to what eventually will be an empty nest. But it's like the slowest stopping, startingest thing ever. So the kids will leave, then they come back, then one leaves, then one comes back. And if you have young adult kids, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about right now. And then even the kids who are still home, the teenagers, I mean, they still need me, but it's just not the same as the way they needed me when they were babies or 5 or 10. They've always been their own people, but the older they get, the more I have to kind of hand over the reins and let them figure things out for themselves. And that can be really hard to do. So in this book, I'm going to be sharing not only the story of the stage I'm in right now, but how it intertwines with the stories of these 5 human beings, and how that relationship with your kids changes, and then what's left when you're not the parent in charge of everything anymore. I'm having to ask myself, what is this new relationship I'm trying to form with my children as they get older, as they become adults? It's pretty loaded, I have to say. And there's a lot of temptation to simplify it all and to only tell the stories or remember the stories that kind of paint me in this light of having everything figured out. Maybe being the mom with the fisherman hat with all the pins on it, right? Basically to make myself the hero of the story with nothing but answers to share and nothing but wisdom. And I'm really resisting that temptation. Because much like smug little Megan reading Bible verses to win prizes, I just don't think it makes for a very good story. In fact, if you look back at the same Bible verses I was memorizing, you can kind of see the truth in that. And maybe that can tell me, as a writer, something about how to write a story that's good and hopeful, and how to help humans see, as the Bible did, that overall story of humanity and God and our place in this big picture. I keep thinking about the Bible, and not just because it's a bestseller, although it's good to keep your eye on that when you're writing a book. But I think I'm thinking about it because I know that the reason this story endures and touches people and changes lives is because it's real and it's hopeful. So if the Bible was just full of people doing everything right and the lesson was just to do everything like them, or if it was only about people doing everything wrong and the lesson was to do nothing like them, then it would be a textbook or an instruction manual. Like, follow these tips and you can be holy too. But it's not that. It's not an instruction manual and it's not a textbook. It's a collection of stories that connect us to the entire human story. And so in order for these stories to help us feel connected, they have to be true and they have to be hopeful. And I think they're hopeful because in reading them, we see people just like ourselves. And we see that those people were real and flawed, and yet they still belonged in the story. So like I shared, as a kid, I read a lot of the Bible. Probably most of it went over my head. And I think kids often get these sort of sanitized versions of the story anyway. We just learn certain verses or certain stories. So I learned about David and Goliath and Daniel in the lion's den and Noah's Ark and dozens of stories like that. And they were thrilling and exciting. And the way they were presented to me, or at least the way I understood them, was that there was a clear message that God's people were good, always good, heroic, and that their righteousness would be rewarded. So then as an adult, I was away from the Bible for quite a long time. And when I returned to it, I gotta say, I was in for a rude awakening. It was totally different returning to the text with grown-up reading comprehension skills. And then to be reading it all the way through instead of just simplified versions of the most popular stories. And my first thought was, oh my goodness, all these people are terrible. All those verses I had thought as a kid were about heroic and holy people getting their just rewards turned out to be a lot more seedy. There's pretty rampant greed and violence and lust and deception and trickery and adultery. The Bible, especially the Old Testament, is basically one big Jerry Springer episode. And of course, there's heroic moments, but then they're all wrapped up with the rest of it. Like one page, you read about someone doing something gallant and wonderful, and then you turn the page and you're like, wait, they did what to who with what? Huh? Oh. And once in a while in the Old Testament, God gets really fired up and he makes a point of showing his displeasure. But sometimes, often actually, the person just gets away with it. Or they seem to get away with it. And the gallant and the wonderful thing and then the terrible thing are both just wrapped up in one story. And then we as the reader have to sort of sort it out. And you know, I really struggled with that for a long time because I think I only wanted the Bible to be full of stories of gallant people doing wonderful things and getting rewarded for it or doing terrible things and getting punished for it. I wanted it to be full of victims getting avenged and the righteous getting rewarded and then the villains paying for their crimes. And I wanted it to be really clear which group was which. But instead, we get a story of humanity, people who are victims and villains and heroes, sometimes all at the same time. So that's a different story than what I thought I'd find, but it's really the story of being human.
Okay, friends, you have already heard me talk about my new Uptown loafers from our sponsor, Vionic. I love these versatile, classic, and comfy slip-on shoes, and the Uptown loafer is part of the Vionic Vitals collection, which is what I want to tell you about today. Vionic Vitals contains some of Vionic's most versatile daily styles. So if you've been curious about Vionic but are overwhelmed by all the choices, start with the Vitals collection first. The Willa Flat was my very first Vionic style, and I have been in love with it for years. I'm also eyeballing the Chardonnay heeled sandal for summer date nights. Like all of Vionic's footwear, the shoes in the Vionic Vitals line are super comfortable, stable, and supportive with Vionic's exclusive VioMotion technology. Go to vionicshoes.com/vitals to find the Vitals collection and use the code TEASEMADE at checkout for 15% off your entire order plus free shipping when you log into your account. That code is good for a one-time use only, so be sure to make the most of it. That's TEASEMADE, TEASMADE, for 15% off your entire order at vionicshoes.com.
Okay, so let's get back to talking about my brother throwing up on the rug, okay? Why not? This is my payback for all those times he got away with not doing the dishes or jumping out and scaring me before bed or getting to use the better fork. Anyway, 3.5 decades after that happened, my brother and I still tell that story a lot. And yeah, there's the gross out factor. That always gets a laugh. But personally, I think the story is a lot stronger when I set it up with my brother groaning and squirming on the sofa looking like a dentist's worst nightmare, contrasted with me being so good, sitting there with my Bible and my pins and my clean teeth. And then we get to the part where he turns the house into a horror movie set. Because if I just told the part about myself reading the Bible, it would be very boring. I promise you, not one time since 1986 has anyone said, like, kids, climb up on grandpa's knee and let me tell you a story about this little girl who won every single pin for her hat for reading Bible verses. That's not a good story. It's boring, first of all, but it's also just kind of obnoxious. And the only thing that makes my goodness relatable at all is to point out how actually ridiculous and false and what a veneer it was. And actually, just throwing up on a rug isn't a great story either. What makes the two together so funny and so relatable is the contrast between the smug person covering up their own flaws with this false goodness and righteousness, and then the person whose mistakes are so plainly visible, like in the case of my brother, all over the floor. So I've been keeping all of this in mind while I'm deciding which stories to share in my book. I don't want them to be all the stories that make me look like an amazingly well-adjusted human who got my kids through childhood without a hitch and launched them all one by one into successful adult lives perfectly on schedule. I don't think that book would go very far. It'd be like two stories maybe, and they'd be kind of lies. And then those kids leapt gracefully into their lives, and the mom leaps gracefully into the next stage of her life. And if you follow my tips, you can too. That's not true. And it wouldn't be relatable. But I also don't want it to be all complaints about this stage of life either, or all self-deprecation, because that wouldn't be true and it wouldn't be relatable. I think what I'm trying to do instead is for someone who's facing this period of transition from one kind of life into another kind of life to read this book and realize they have company. Their struggles aren't new, and that someone else right now is going through something very similar. And I want to acknowledge that things can be really hard while also giving the reader hope that ultimately they're going to be okay. And that is ultimately what the Bible does, even the NC-17 parts. Just like the characters in those stories I memorized as a kid and then had to kind of relearn with adult eyes, I've kept messing up over and over throughout my life, often in the same ways I messed up way back then. I don't actually collect pins for a hat anymore, and in a lot of ways, life has humbled me, but I've still got pride and smugness and ways I try to set myself apart as righteous so that I can feel safe or worthy or get other people to pat me on the head, maybe. I will say, though, that since I've been picking a lot of my brother this morning, I don't think he's thrown up on anyone else's rug since. So he has made some progress. Good for him. But, you know, looking back at that night all those decades ago, I really got to hand it to my mom. Those were stressful times for our family, and her especially, and she could have taken out a lot of her frustration on my brother. She could have really laid on the guilt. She could have gone totally nuclear, and I think anyone would understand. But I actually don't think she said a word about that rug, not that night, never again later, except to join us in laughing at it, about it, you know, later, like way later when she was able to laugh about it. In that moment, my mom had a choice to punish or to kind of let the natural consequences stand, as they already had, right? To extend grace and roll up the rug. And that's what she did. It occurred to me as I was writing this talk that some of the same things that make the Bible stories so real and true, but sometimes confusing, is that God treats us the same way I want to treat my kids, but often fail to treat my kids, especially now that they're getting so much older and most of them are adults. In this stage of parenting, I'm struggling with a little slice of what Mike Gathright often refers to as God's problem. I want to have loving relationships with my kids. I want them to do the right thing because it's good for them. But I want to give them the freedom to choose the right paths for themselves and give them the freedom to be themselves. I want to make sure they know they're accepted no matter what, but I have standards and I don't want them to make choices that will hurt them either. So how do I balance those things? How do I know when it's time to sit back and let things play out, let the natural consequences happen? And when it's time to, like, do a little smiting. I'm still figuring it out. But the Bible and the way God and Jesus show up in those stories all remind us that in the madness and the greed and the violence and the vanity and the foolishness of human history, The constant is that we've never been alone. We aren't alone now, and we won't be alone in the future. And as a parent, I also know that means God does not approve of everything we do, just as I don't approve of everything my kids do. But Jesus is there to remind us that even at those most flawed moments, even in the flawed parts we play, whether right now you're playing the villain or the victim or the hero, whether in this moment you're the rug puker or the pin hoarder, whatever you've done, whoever you are, there's someone on your side. Over and over, Jesus reminds us that there's room for all of us. The Gospels are stuffed with stories of Jesus essentially saying, you belong. And that included both the people who wore their mistakes very publicly, like the woman caught in adultery, or those who hid their failings under an outward guise of goodness, like the Pharisees, who, by the way, Jesus criticized, but this is something I didn't really realize until recently. He also befriended them. He still made space for them in the story. And if there's room for those people in the story, and the characters from all the Bible stories I was reading as a kid, then there's room for the smug little girl with the pins on her hat, and there's room for the rebellious glutton, and there's room for the harried mom who just wants to get through the night without anything else going sideways. And there's room for the neighbor next door who maybe gossips to another neighbor about watching these people, you know, carrying a rolled up rug out to the curb under cover of night. And there's room, definitely room, for the poor trash guys who had to pick it up the next day. By the way, I really hope they picked it up like this and not like that. My point is that we've all been more than one of those characters, because in some ways we are every single character in every single story. We're the victim, we're the villain, we're the hero, sometimes all in the same paragraph. And the one thing that really makes it feel okay somehow is the thread of connection that holds us together, and that reminder that in those stories, like now, we have never really been alone. You know, one of my favorite things about the family I grew up in and the family that I've raised are that we are a bunch of storytellers. We all tell stories about each other and about ourselves as a unit. And I love that there's room for all of us in the stories. In fact, what I think makes our stories so great is that everybody gets to have a part. It's a really important way to remind us all that we belong. And that's why the more I kind of dig into the Bible, the more impressed I am with how it includes everyone and everything. Everyone you know, everyone you are, everything you've done or have been tempted to do, it's all there. And looking at the Bible through that lens, that this is a story where these real, imperfect, sometimes extremely flawed people still get to belong in God's world, still got to hang out with Jesus. That really helped me make sense of some stuff that on first read just came across as a mess of like dysfunctional drama. Because it's true, we humans are pretty full of dysfunction and drama and ruined carpets. But because of grace, we also get to belong. None of us are really alone. And I think that is a reason to keep reading those stories and sharing our own stories with each other.
Thank you again for listening to this episode, friends. And I hope you enjoyed hearing something a little different this week. If anything about this week's episode moved you, or you have any questions or want to make a comment, I would love to hear from you. Shoot me an email at meganfrancis@gmail.com. That's meganfrancis@gmail.com. And let me know what's on your mind. That's all for this episode of The Teas Made. You can find links to the products and other things we talked about today in the show notes for this episode. You can find that by scrolling down below the episode in your podcast app, or you can go to theteasmade.com and find all the episodes, plus resources, links to my favorite teas and books and other products, and so much more. I share new episodes every Thursday, so please follow or subscribe so you don't miss a thing. And while you're in your podcast app, I would love if you'd leave a rating or review. It really helps me out so much. Okay, friends, that's all for now. I will talk to you again very soon. If you're enjoying the Teas Made podcast, I would love for you to check out my blog, which is also called The Teas Made. We're doing something called the So Slow Book Club, where I'm writing about the same book all year long, and I'm writing regular essays on everything from sending kids to college to why and what I'm loving creating in the kitchen these days. When you subscribe for free, you'll get my posts in your email inbox, or you can jump in on the conversation over at my page. I also have some optional goodies for paid subscribers that you're going to want to check out too. Spring is here, and I have a long list of topics I'm planning to cover. Everything from updated skincare recommendations to some recipes for fun spring-themed beverages. Come join the conversation about connection and creativity at theteasemade.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.